www.thebeatles.org.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Nice chilly day out there today, but it's actually going to get colder, according to forecaster Roger Hill. Yes, let's blame the weatherman. Coming up on the program today, we're going to preview what's going to be happening at the Vermont legislative session, which opens up tomorrow. We'll be broadcasting there for the rest of the week after today. So we'll be down there on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We have a great lineup of guests that will be joining us coming up tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday. I will tell you all about that as we proceed throughout the course of the morning. Coming up at about 10:15 this morning, we're anticipating a visit by Republican gubernatorial candidate Scott Milne. So we'll find out where things are at with his effort to become governor. It, as many of you know, no candidate receiving 50% of the vote at the November election. So the 180 lawmakers are going to be making the decision. That's going to happen on Thursday, and that's anticipated to be either late morning. So we'll hopefully be able to, we'll break that story way ahead of, you know, people like the Vermont Political Observer and Vermont Digger. We're going to get right down to business this morning. We'd love to hear from you on the program this morning. If you have any questions or comments about the legislative session, this is a golden opportunity for you to ask, and you can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning. John Walters blogs for the Vermont Political Observer, and Ann Galloway is the founder of VTDigger.com. Thank you both for coming in. Thanks. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
Thanks for dragging us out on this chilly morning.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. And you actually you get coffee as a result of that.
Yes.
Dragging yourself out. John, let me start with you. I just mentioned Scott Milne's going to be joining us coming up in about an hour. You recently wrote on your blog that they're all of a sudden now everybody's interested in constitutional amendments. How come?
Well, I don't know. It must be something in the wind because, you know, this thing has been going on with Milne for, you know, 2 months. And just in the last few days, it seems like everybody's talking constitutional amendment to change this process. The Vermont Constitution, you know, mandates that if no gubernatorial candidate gets more than 50% of the vote, then the legislature chooses the governor from the top three finishers. And that is seen by many as an antiquated process that has worked okay as long as there has been kind of a consensus, informal consensus among politicians that, you know, if there isn't a majority winner, then the top finisher will take office. And now that Scott Milne has kind of thrown a monkey wrench into that, suddenly people are faced with a process that seems designed to cause trouble. It was enacted at a time when legislators were filled a much different role than they do today. You know, legislators were supposed to act out of their own judgment. They were not direct representatives of the people so much as, you know, the wise person meant to interpret the desires of the people, you know, and also consider the best interests of the state. And these days, politicians are expected to listen to their constituents and, you know, act on behalf of their constituents. And so this process does seem to be out of date and subject to gaming controversy, and so suddenly everybody's talking constitutional amendment, which I found interesting because even those who are supporting Scott Milne's candidacy and intend to vote for him on Thursday are now saying this process is broken and we need to change it.
Right. But right after this round.
Yes, after
here.
This round.
Uh-huh. And let me have you comment on that as well.
Well, I think the reason why this has picked up steam is because a couple of weeks ago, a group called Vermonters for Honest Government launched a real campaign. They put TV ads up on WCAX and PTZ. They asked people to phone their lawmakers and urge them to vote for Milne. So it actually became a campaign. And I think that's the difference. We haven't seen that before. And so people were freaked out by it, and that's why I think folks are thinking about the constitutional amendment. I talked to Garrison Nelson about this the other day, and he said something really interesting, which is that the reason we have this constitutional we're one of two states in the country that still allows the legislature to decide the outcome of the election in an instance like this. The other one is Mississippi. But also he said that in New England states, there was a lot of distrust of the British Crown, and they actually chose the governors. And so that's one of the reasons why this is a vestige of colonial times, essentially, wherein, you know, the legislature had a little more power than the executive branch did. I guess the other thing I would say is, to John's point about the delegate versus trustee responsibilities of the lawmakers, right. I think there's a lot of tension there between, do I represent my constituents? Do I, answer to my own conscience? Do I think about the public good in a broader way beyond my own personal constituency? So it's a really interesting dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I think we will, you know, Senator Bill Doyle has said he's going to propose a constitutional amendment. It's a very long process. This is the year to do it. There's a four-year lock-in, and 2015 happens to be the year you can do it. But then it's basically they have to get it through the House, and well, it starts in the Senate, has to get through the Senate, has to get through the House, and then they have to wait an election cycle and see whether or not voters respond by voting people out of office, and then they take it up again to ratify it. So it's a four-year process. Wow. And you know, so the bar is really high. Whether or not they could pull it off is really an open question, but it could have an impact on the next election cycle, because as we know, we're going to see a progressive candidate, and we probably will see a Democratic primary, and we'll see maybe a Republican primary, in which case, you know, there will be a lot of attention on that race. It's a presidential election year. A lot of people will come out to vote, and that we could see the same thing, a split of votes under 50%.
Mm-hmm. John, you've been critical of Scott Milne for not conceding, but isn't he just playing by the rules the way they are set up today?
He is, and I certainly can't, you know, slam him for his tactics, because his tactics have taken him far longer than I or anybody else ever thought they would. I guess I have more of a problem with the Republicans who are supporting him openly, because I don't think they take him seriously as a candidate. I haven't seen any sign since the election of any unity between the Republican Party and Scott Milne. He never appears at their public events. They never refer to him as the potential governor-elect, except when they are talking about voting for him in the legislature. They never talk about him in terms of what policies they'd like to pursue. They seem to kind of assume that Governor Shumlin will be reelected. So I don't think, and I don't see much respect for Scott Milne among the political classes of either, of any party. So I don't think anyone really wants him to be governor. I think the Republicans are just using him as a convenient, you know, hammer to hit the Democrats with.
Okay, but why does it matter what the Republican leadership thinks in terms of what he decides to do, and not conceding or conceding?
Well, it doesn't, but I think they've encouraged a process that raises issues of legitimacy and raises uncertainties about future elections. If we get to 2016 and we have a three-way race, and let's say Phil Scott wins 48% of the vote, the Democrat wins 44%, and the progressive wins 7%, then you have a 51% liberal majority. And now you have opened the door to Democrats and progressives saying, well, let's elect a Democrat, because there were more liberal voters than there were conservative voters. I think the Republicans have been kind of disingenuous about all this. And not that they have a monopoly on disingenuousness, but I think that they have just used this to conveniently stir up some trouble. And when you see people like Joe Benning actually saying they want to change the system, even while they are taking advantage of the current system, I don't like that. I don't blame Scott Milne for what he's doing, but I blame them for encouraging Scott Milne.
And what do you know about this group that launched this media campaign? Who are they? Were they working with Scott Milne, or what's going on with that?
I don't really know much about them. I think it's a fairly small group. It's led by a guy named Bill Round, who lives in Newport Center. He's a former Army captain, and you know, he's spent some money on ads, $30,000. I wish I knew more about them, but I've been a little overwhelmed with the holidays and being the sole soldier on the desk at the BT Digger, so I haven't had a chance to dig into that. But I would just say, to tack onto what John was saying about the Republicans, is that I think this is still a very anti-Shumlin situation. I think they just want to, like John was saying, they want to give Shumlin trouble. They want to make it difficult for him. So that's what this is about. This isn't necessarily about supporting Milne, I don't think. And the way we would find out if that's true or not is if they had a roll call vote on the floor, which they could do if lawmakers decided that they wanted to change House and Senate rules tomorrow. They could do that on the first day of the session. They could say, you know what, we're going to have a roll call vote instead of a secret ballot on Thursday, so that lawmakers can declare where they stand. Do they stand for Milne or do they stand for Shumlin? And I think that would actually be a really great thing if someone wanted to take that leadership role on and suggest that on the floor of the House and on the floor of the Senate, because then we would know.
Right. Don't you think at this point they have to? I mean, all this talk about transparency all the time, if they had a secret vote on this, I mean, that would be a joke.
Yeah, but that's what they're probably going to do, Mark. I mean, I'd like to think that they do differently, but I they tend to ignore calls for transparency.
Huh. What do you think about that, John? You think they'll get away with that?
Yeah. I would like to think that they would opt for an open vote. But they do tend to give lip service to transparency and, slow play any actual action on transparency. Especially when it touches on their own interests.
Mm-hmm. So is this, it can be one person that asks for this?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, one person can ask.
180?
Yeah, but then they have to actually vote on it.
Okay.
You know, so it takes more than one. But one person has to stand up and say it, ask for it.
Right.
And if that doesn't happen, then, of course, you know, nothing will be done. But it would be very interesting to hear what the roll call vote would be on that suggestion.
Right. Right. I mean, it would be almost indicative. You could almost interpret how they would vote on the next vote.
Indeed.
Sort of. Or they could just declare how they're going to vote so it wouldn't lead to any speculation. You can join us on the program this morning at 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. We're talking with Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger and John Walters of the Vermont Political Observer. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
The first full week of 2015 brings the toughest challenges yet for the Norwich University Cadets. I'm George Como. It starts Tuesday night in Plattsburgh as the Cadets travel to the Ronald B. Stafford Ice Arena and a rematch with the Plattsburgh State Cardinals. Norwich beat Plattsburgh in the Prime Link. Now the Cardinals look for revenge. Join Corey Gustafson and me, Norwich-Plattsburgh Hockey, Tuesday night at 6:35, right here on the Northfield Savings Bank, WDEV, Norwich Hockey Network.
Our next guest has been a major star since, well, the beginning of time, literally. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to The Sun. Son, how do you manage to look so amazing at a zillion years old?
Clean living, Jimmy. And I keep very busy. Folks are now using my energy to power their lives, heat their homes, and fuel their cars.
You're producing like a kabazillion megawatts, right? That's crazy.
All in a day's work, Jimmy. In Vermont alone, I'm now providing the power to generate electricity for thousands and thousands of households.
Why, son, that's heartwarming.
Not just hearts, Jimmy. Heads, fingers, toes.
That's great, son. More fun with the sun after this break.
SunCommon helps Vermonters go solar with no upfront costs and a low fixed monthly payment. And with the best solar panels provided by industry leader SunPower, heating your home with solar power has never made more sense. Energy from the sun is clean, reliable, affordable, and SunCommon makes it easy to save money and go solar. Check out SunCommon.com.
Two four four 1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. We've been talking with reporters and bloggers. Ann Galloway joining us, and also John Walters. Let's go to the phone, and let's head over to Barry Paul. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I just, you know, was listening to your show, and I think you know who I am.
Paul Poirier, yes.
You're right. Uh-huh. And I just want to know, I mean, some of us have looked into this. We would love to have a, you know, a public vote on this. But we have been told that, you know, by the clerk, inquiries were made to actually the clerk of the Senate, because the Senate presides over the joint session, that, you know, that it is not a question of getting it. It's in the Constitution. It's not in the Senate or House rules. But I'll tell you right now, most of the legislators I talk to, a lot of us would love to see a public vote on the issue.
Okay, are you saying you've been told that's not going to happen? I didn't understand what you were saying.
No, what we've been told is that it's not a matter of just getting up and asking for example, to, you know, suspend the rules, to change the rule or whatever. It's in the Constitution, and we can't make a motion to change the Constitution in a parliamentary motion on the floor Thursday morning. We're committed to a secret ballot as interpreted by, you know, by the Constitution. And I'm speaking for myself now, but I know many others are disappointed in that ruling. And, Mark, I just like to go back, you know, back in 1987, remember Jim Douglas wanted to bring in voting booths for the election for Speaker that year?
All right. I don't remember that, but I'll take your word for it. At the time, I was
the Democratic leader, and I stood up and asked for a roll call vote on whether or not Douglas could make us vote by using the voting booths that he had borrowed from the city of Montpelier. And that was defeated, and we voted in our traditional way.
So I just,
for your reporters and everybody else, there are many legislators who really would like to be on record on this vote. Some of us already have expressed our public position on this. But if I'm wrong, I would love to see one of your guests tell me where they believe that an individual legislator or anybody could make a motion. Because
John wants to take a crack at it.
Yeah, well, okay.
I'll hang up and listen.
Wait. Don't go anywhere. Hold on.
I actually have a question for you. But first, I do want to mention that I have read, and I don't remember where, but I have read something that says what Representative Poirier is saying. I think that people are parsing the wording of the Constitution very closely these days, and in some cases interpreting it as best meets their interests. I take the representative's word on that, what he's been told. But I would ask you, would you support, and do you think there's a lot of support just for individual lawmakers stating publicly what their own vote is, even though it's on a secret ballot? And do you think a lot of lawmakers would be willing to do that in the public interest?
I've had people calling me and asking, I declared right after the election, I think I was the very first person that said that I was going to vote for Scott Mill. And I said it, back right, maybe a day or two after the election, because he carried my district. And I believe that my district sent me a message. And this whole issue of whether I'm a trustee or delegate. I believe in this case, you know, where I go and I represent the city of Barrie, the voters in Barrie overwhelmingly voted for Scott Mill. It's been my litmus test. I did that with Madeline Cunin, and so that's what I believe. Other people disagree with me, and they believe that that's something we can, you know, people can argue over. But I believe that every citizen should have a right to know how their legislators vote. And I've encouraged people. People say to me, what can I do? I say, call your legislator and ask them how they're going to vote. And if they don't tell you, just tell them that, that you'll remember that in 2 years. I think it should be open. It's a very important vote. And I would hope that maybe Don Turner, the Republicans, have looked into this and, you know, would make a motion or would look into it. But like I said, what I've been told is that, you know, it's pretty, the ruling would be that this is a constitutional issue and that, you know, it cannot, it's not a change, it's not a changing of House and Senate rules.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome.
It.
Have a good day.
You too.
Well, I'm looking at one interpretation of the Constitution. The word that's used is ballot, and the question is whether or not the ballot implies secret ballot. And so state officials have interpreted that word to mean secret. But the word secret is actually not in the Constitution. The word ballot is. And so it really is a matter of interpretation.
Hmm. All right. Wow. Let's go to Corinth. Forbes, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Mark?
Good.
The political reality here, if you open that vote to an open or roll call vote, you're not going to allow a representative to vote their true convictions as to what would be best for the state of Vermont and its people.
Wait a minute. Why do you say that?
Because let's say you're a member of the Democratic Party and you get up and vote for Scott Milne openly. You don't think there wouldn't be political reprisal from that? Of course it would be. That's reality.
There are political reprisals for every vote on the floor.
Well, it'd be more so that way. You wouldn't allow anyone to cross over and not suffer whatever consequences might come out of it politically.
I can tell you that the House and Senate leaders are not whipping this vote. They've said they don't care.
Well, if you look at just the numbers between the two political parties, that's an automatic win for Shumlin if you have an open vote. Guaranteed.
Okay.
Second part, mm-hmm. If a candidate doesn't receive 50% of the vote, it should go to a runoff vote. Let the people make that decision, not just the political appointees at that particular time. Bring it back to the people. That's who it most will affect.
All right.
Runoff election.
Thanks for your call, Forbes. I appreciate it. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Do you think there's any chance the momentum stays with this, or is this going to be something we're not even talking about in a month?
Oh, I think the momentum's going to stay with it because there are implications for 2016. And it's going to be an ongoing problem because no one party, I think, is really going to have control now. Mm-hmm. I mean, because of what's happened with Shumlin, because of the backlash for property taxes, and for a variety of reasons, I think that power is really split right now. And so we're going to have this come up again and again because Milne has made it so.
Let's go to Williamstown. Rama, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I had two quick points to make, the second of which I believe is definitely much more important. But the first one is I really don't want to see a roll call vote on this legislative vote for governor for the simple reason that I don't want these legislators to know how every other legislator before them voted prior to that legislator casting her or his vote. I want them to cast their vote the way that they think they should be casting it. And in other words, you know, I don't want to see somebody playing a safe bet because all of a sudden, hey, I know I can vote for this guy because this other guy already won.
You mean like kind of like what Peter Welch does sometimes on those votes down in Washington?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a horrible way to do it. Now, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything that doesn't say that says that you can't make those ballots public after the vote. But that said, my second point, and this one I think is really much more important, is you know, yeah, I can see the need for the constitutional amendment, although I think we could just go with IRV and skip the constitutional amendment. But constitutional amendment makes it more firm regarding how we elect some statewide offices. But a much bigger question and a much bigger topic that will have much greater impact and immediate impact on all of our lives is this question about education funding, education costs, and our education system. And if we spend too much time on constitutional amendments about how we elect a governor, which we can live with the system we have now. It's imperfect, but we will end up with a governor. We could possibly end up without a public education system. And that's what worries me, is that we will draw attention away from the really vital issue of the day.
Well, Rama,
that's going to take 2 years anyway. I mean, it's going to take the whole biennium to do property tax reform. So there's probably room.
Thank you for your call. I actually want to start. I want to talk about a couple of issues. Let's start with health care. As our listeners, many know, the governor has basically dropped this idea of coming up with this single-payer financing plan. And there's been some speculation out there in the media, some observers saying that really that the governor kind of made it so that this plan would blow up, that he made it too difficult a plan to go forward. So what do you two think on that theory? And let me start with you on that.
Well, the governor went with a high-priced plan. He went with a plan with a 94% actuarial value. And what that means is that the state would have picked up 94% of the tab for your health insurance, and you would be responsible for 6%, right? And this was billed as a replica of what's existing in the marketplace now, because more than 70% of Vermonters, he said, have a high actuarial value plan. But if you look closely at the numbers in the report, which Morgan True and I are doing now, you can see that if you back the public sector employees out, that's no longer true. If you take the teachers and the municipal employees and the state workers and the retired workers in those industries out, you wind up with a much smaller number of Vermonters who have high high value plans like that. So some people are saying that he was trying to appease certain advocates and the unions on the score. The Shaw report that came out in 2011 recommended an 87% actuarial value plan. If you go to an 80% plan, which is Medicare, you would save $1 billion. And, if you went to an 87% valued plan, you'd be at much less than $2.6 billion. We're hearing $2.3 billion. Still verifying that number. It could be less. There's also money that he put in this thing for out-of-state workers who come to Vermont. They would be included in the plan, and that costs $200 million. What else? There are no savings here. Shaw had four areas of savings: administrative, yeah, integrated delivery, tort reform, and the fourth one was, I'm forgetting.
There were four
areas, yeah, of savings, and those aren't being, yeah. Oh, I know, 5% is fraud and abuse. 5% of expenditures is fraud and abuse, according to Shaw. So we didn't claim any of that. And Shaw said you could save 16% at minimum over time if you implemented single payer, because you'd have savings in these areas. And what the administration said, what the Shumlin administration said, was you could get administrative savings are built into the 4% increases a year, right, that they're planning on. But, they weren't factoring in anything else for savings. And so, obviously, it was a heavy lift to begin with, but it was mostly a heavy lift politically. And we're talking to people now who are saying that this could set the single-payer movement back decades, because instead of blaming the waivers, instead of blaming, the Republican Congress, he's essentially saying it can't be done. And, so whatever you think about single-payer, it's a big moment.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, though, if those numbers that you talked about would have had a big difference on the payroll and the income tax.
Yeah, they would have. Well, we broke that story about 8%.
Right.
The 8% payroll tax was being considered at that last business council meeting in November. And they actually hadn't run the numbers completely. And so at that time, they thought that the system was going to cost $1.6 billion. And when Gruber started running the numbers, it became a $2.6 billion plan, especially if you raise the actuarial value up to 94%.
So did the Gov put the thumb on the scale there, John?
Well, there are certainly a lot of signs that he did. I look forward to the fully reported piece on VT Digger, which should be coming out any day now. But
can I just note, in terms of thumbs on a scale, you got a big bad Band-Aid on your thumb?
Yes,
there.
I do. Yep. I cut my thumb while I was
putting it on a scale.
Pickling turnips, not putting it on a scale.
Nice.
If I put my thumb on the scale, nobody notices. no, it's Hamilton Davis, a policy expert who has a blog, and I don't know what it's called, but he has a very good piece from his point of view that points out all the ways in which, you know, Shumlin could have reduced the cost of the system, and he chose a higher cost option, or he chose a higher estimate of costs, or, as Ann just said, he chose not to credit any administrative savings. So there's a lot of evidence that, well, Davis's conclusion is that Shumlin wanted single-payer, but he saw that it wasn't going to be politically possible, so he just sort of loaded all this other stuff on it to make it seem like it just wasn't feasible, rather than that he couldn't do it. And I think there's a strong case to be made for that. And as Ann said, it does certainly set the cause of single-payer back significantly. I don't know whether Shumlin really did this or not. The problem, the big problem Shumlin has these days is that basically everybody thinks he's capable of doing that. Everybody thinks he's devious and thinks he's out for number one all the time. And that's a big problem that I don't know how he's going to overcome in dealing with any number of issues for the rest of his governorship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you found a word. I was struggling to find what the word was. I mean, devious. I mean, it would be breathtakingly devious.
Especially on his own number one policy initiative, as he has said since he was originally running in 2010, and it was the issue that separated him from a very crowded Democratic field. And there were suspicions on the left way back then that he wasn't really serious about it. And this only feeds those suspicions, whether the suspicions are warranted or not. I think there's often Shumlin is criticized too much for deviousness. I think his image feeds into that. I think he acts honestly in a lot of cases, but he never gets credit for it because he seems to be devious. He sometimes acts in those ways, and people have come to expect it.
And do you see any effort made to reopen this, given, I mean, are lawmakers hip to this? I mean, is anybody going to say, hey, rerun the numbers, give us an 80% plan?
I would say at this point, the advocates are somewhat in disarray. They do not, I've interviewed three or four of them, and none of them are willing to say what they want going forward. You know, there are people in the legislature like Tim Ash and Chris Pearson, both of whom are progressive standard bearers, who want to pick away at it. You know, they have ideas around saving money that are similar to the governor's, actually. There's been talk of a single-payer plan for hospitals, but there's nothing concrete there. It's just an idea at this point. So really, the air has kind of gone out of the balloon. People don't know how to respond. I'm not sure what we're going to see exactly. But I guess I wanted to add something to what you said about the devious factor. I think the reason why the governor is perceived this way sometimes is because he makes these blanket statements that then he's gonna live to regret. Like he said recently, when he said that he was going to back off the plan, weeks later he had a press conference and he said this was never, this was not about politics at all. In his press conference, and he said this over and over again, and that's just hard to believe.
It's always at least partly about politics.
Exactly. So why not say that? I mean, you know, it's okay. He's a politician. Like it should partly be about politics. If it's not, you know, if he's not going to be able to get the hospitals and the providers and the unions and the business community on board, which is essentially what he was saying, then it's not politically feasible. And, you know, he could have tried to carry them along. He could have found ways to do that. You could argue that. Maybe he tried to do that. We don't know, you know.
Mm-hmm. Wonder if he'd won 65% of the vote if he could.
Well, that would have helped. Yeah, that would have helped. Right. He didn't have that ringing endorsement from the public either. And so that's a big issue.
844-1777 is our local number. Toll free, 877-291-8255. We're talking with Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger, John Walters of the Vermont Political Observer. If you want to read Ham Davis's piece, he blogs under avermontjournal.org. A moment of your time for our friends at Greenmount and Access. If you're looking for an outstanding local internet service provider, make it our friends at gmavt.net. You can call them toll free at 1-888-321-0815. And on the web, gmavt.net. If you own a business, you need an internet partner for 2015, and they have all sorts of services in addition to their fabulous webmail services, so check it out at gmavt.net. Let's head up to Craftsbury. Frank, how you doing this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
All right.
I just want to get back to that little back and forth between Forbes and Ian, where Forbes suggested that there's going to be some punishment for Democrats that may vote for Milne if it's a public vote. And, you know, Forbes suggested that there was going to be some, you know, some punishment by Shummy and John and Schaap. And she seemed to really perk up in her seat there. And, you know, she stated that, oh, she talked with the leaders and the leaders have told her that that wouldn't happen. I mean, is Ann so naive that she really believes that the Shummy and John and Schaap had come out and told her that, yes, there would be punishment for people who voted for Milne, Democrats who voted for Milne? I mean, I think not. I mean, Ann, come on. Really? I mean, this is why some of us are still continue to be outraged by the way you guys treat Milne like some kind of bomb. I mean, if you really want to do some digging, you guys need to get out of the office and start getting in some barns out in the Northeast Kingdom or some of these places an hour and a half away from Burlington. Get out of your office. Take some time to get some fresh air and get out and stand in some convenience stores and listen to what real people, common people, are saying about politicians and the way government is operating. I mean, it's just outrageous. You guys celebrate a person like Snowden, but yet me, when I out Vermont butter and cheese for exploiting farmers for 25 years, you guys want to bury your heads in the sand. In fact, Ann, you wouldn't even respond to a letter I sent you. I'm just outraged the way you guys are so naive. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, gosh, I'm not sure where to start. First of all, I don't know if they would be punished or not. I was saying that the House leaders have said they're not going to whip the vote, and that means that they're not going to ask lawmakers to vote for Shumlin. I mean, in the caucus, the Democratic caucus. What the Republican caucus is doing there, I'm not sure. You know, I do live in Hardwick, by the way, and about 100 feet from a farm, but that's besides the point. I take your point that we do need to spend more time, you know, with
you never hang out
folks.
You never hang out in Burlington.
I actually don't.
Yeah, I know. I'm the only one that seems to.
Yeah, no, I drive 40 minutes every day to Montpelier, but
I think
yeah,
we all,
fair enough.
And
I think
all three of us here have conceded that the election coverage could have been better, and that we can all improve and be better every day, whether it's as people or as reporters, right, John?
Well, I got the election dead wrong, and I've been more than happy to say so. One of the problems of being in the media is that your job is to basically be in your office a lot and in places like the State House otherwise. And you don't have much time. In fact, you don't have any time. If you knew how hard people like Mark and Ann work, you would realize that they just don't have time to, spend much time in barns, much as they might prefer barns to legislature, for all I know. And it might smell a little better from time to time. But I wouldn't say that there's not going to be any punishment for Democrats who would vote in an open ballot for Milne. They might be looked at askew, especially if Milne were to somehow prevail. But I don't think I don't think that outweighs the public interest in having an open ballot. I think the people deserve to know how their legislators would vote for something this important, way more important than any individual bill would be. So, I would support an open ballot just for that reason. And, politicians are big boys, and if they take a little heat for a vote, I think they can stand it. If they can't, they should get out of the kitchen.
Let's go to Middlebury. David, good morning.
I would just like to make a comment on a statement that was made earlier in the program about how we expect our representatives to vote. I, for one, expect our representatives to vote their conscience, so to speak, to not always vote the way they think that their constituents would want them to vote. The general public is not always on the right side of every issue, especially moral issues. And that's just a comment I would like to make.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Anything you guys want to add to that?
I don't think so. It's a perfectly valid point of view, and Scott Milne's mother, Marion Milne, is a prime example of that. She voted for civil unions in 2000, and it ended her legislative career.
Let me open a can of worms here with property taxes. You know, a lot of discussion about, a lot of hand-wringing, I guess I would call it. Something's got to be done about property taxes, but wow. I mean, realistically, anything going to get done on this? John, why don't you start us off on that?
Well, I think the legislature almost has to do something. Now, whether they do something that actually addresses property taxes or not is another question. You know, the Democratic leadership seems to be leaning heavily on the idea of restructuring the school management and specifically reducing the number of small schools and some measure of consolidation as a cost-saving measure. Whether that actually cuts any costs or not remains to be seen, and whether that would actually have an effect on property tax rates remains to be seen. But I think if I were to guess right now, I would guess that they will do something like that, and they will call it their solution to property tax rises, whether it's really a solution or not.
What are you hearing?
Well, you know, we're looking to find out what members of the public suggested to the House leadership, and so we're gathering some of that. Those suggestions right now to see what ideas are out there. Right now, I can't say as I've seen anything that's heavily supported by anyone in the House or the Senate.
Nobody's coalescing around a plan or anything?
No, not yet. So the fact that it's still an open question, you know, that there's no shape to it yet at all, leads me to believe that they may tackle part of it this year, but they're not going to get it all done. They may have to either set some kind of framework in place, kind of along the lines of Act 48, which kind of failed, but same concept, or they could try to finish it in the second half of the biennium. The trouble is that if they don't really tackle it this year, they really won't do it next year because it's an election cycle. We hear the same saw every 2 years that they're not going to address changes to the tax code or changes to the property tax formula because it's an election year. So it has to be this year. They have to put something in place or it's not going to happen. And I agree with John. I think there's so much voter dissatisfaction. People want tax relief, but more than that, they feel there's an essential unfairness here that, you know, we've seen this big decline in the number of students in the state, and yet we still have the same number of staff people, and that strikes people as unfair. You know, that we're paying bust-out retail for a system that is pretty good, but it's not, as good as some of the school systems around the world, given how much we spend. And we have the lowest student-to-teacher ratio in the country. We have the lowest student-school board member ratio in the country. We have the highest per-student cost in the country. You know, so you add it all up, and it looks like we're real outliers. And we all believe in education, but, you know, I think a lot of people wonder, you know, well, at what price? You know, is it? Are we getting what we want? First of all, are kids really succeeding, especially kids from families that don't have a lot of money? You know, are they getting a fair shake? And I'm not sure that's necessarily true. So, you know, there are a lot of questions that people have about the education system and how we pay for it.
We're talking with Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger, John Walters of Vermont Political Observer. Let's head to Barry. Tom, good morning.
Yeah, morning, you guys. I'd say a quick, probably more of a statement than a question is, your speaker, Shap Smith, of course, you know, being speaker, he pretty much shapes the agenda for the whole session. And And he was on You Can Quote Me a little while back, and he, one of the questions obviously was about the education, and he came back with an answer that surprised the heck out of me, and that he didn't think there was a problem
with the property taxes. Yeah, he said the same thing about a week ago here. I'm surprised about that.
Expect to get anything out of him if he doesn't seem to think there's a problem, according to him on that talk show that day, and I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay, good question. John, you want to start that? Ann, you want to start?
Well, you know, I think that there... a lot of Democrats who want to protect Act 60 and Act 68 because that law equalized the playing field between towns. And I think they really don't want to mess with the formula. I think their biggest concern is ed spending and how it, you know, doesn't seem to have any kind of lever. You know, they don't have any lever in Montpelier. It's this weird situation where local school districts decide how much they're going to spend, but then the cost is spread out over the state. So essentially, people in Burlington are paying a lot more in taxes because, you know, the town of Craftsbury is a teeny, teeny, tiny school, and it costs them a lot to run it. You know, so, and we have all these subsidies and stuff in place to keep small schools going because they're the hearts of our communities. But there is, you know, I've heard the speaker say that he really wants to address ed spending. So we may see more proposals for consolidation, for a per student cap. You know, so we might see one lawmaker is proposing a $15,000 per student per year cap. So we may see proposals like that. But there is some anxiety about changing the formula. And again, you know, when you're talking about changing the tax system, it's complicated and it could have large economic impacts. And so people are nervous about that. But I'm surprised, frankly, I hadn't heard Shep's comments about property tax reform. And that really surprises me, given how much effort he seems to have put into getting ideas. And it does make you wonder if he's really serious about it. So,
yeah, he basically was saying that he thought, questioned whether or not there was too much spending now, said it really kind of couldn't continue into the future. But I thought it was surprising that he didn't think that there was a problem today.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem, even if he thought that way, it would seem politically unwise to say so.
Well, except, you know, here's the devious thought I had. If you're trying to get support of people like unions, and then, you know, maybe that's the kind of thing that you say, that you try to get the support of the education system, and then he's talking about the Fairpoint thing, so, you know, my mind starts connecting dots out there.
Yes, he commented recently that he thought Fairpoint was trying to screw its workers in order to set itself up for a fire sale, and that Fairpoint would be gone within 5 years.
And like busting, basically accusing him of busting the union.
Yeah. And, you know, I think he's got a point there, but it's interesting when a speaker who's known for his circumspection starts making interesting comments.
Bernie Sanders-like statements, yes.
One thing I wonder, and I'd actually like to ask Ann about this, is it seems to me that education spending is more of a priority in the House than in the Senate. You hear Shep Smith talking about it, you don't hear John Campbell talking about it. Is there a division between the House and the Senate, and could we see something pass in the House and fail in the Senate?
Well, we saw that happen last year.
Yep.
So history does have a way of repeating itself. You know, the Senate doesn't have a strong leader in this area. I think Tim Ash is interested in it. He's head of Senate Finance. And there are some other lawmakers in the Senate who have an interest. David Zuckerman, for example, you know, is on the Education Committee, and he's thrown some ideas out there about phantom students and other subsidy programs that we have. But there isn't a real strong leader on this issue, and I think that's because, first of all, the Education Committee chair hasn't been selected, but it appears to be a job no one wants. Mm-hmm. You know, is the sense I'm getting, having tried to get, you know, everybody wants to be head of natural resources in the Senate, but nobody wants that education job because it's going to be thankless.
So it's definitely not going to be Dick McCormick, or is he trying to be talked into keeping? He didn't sound like he wanted to keep it.
He does not want to keep that chairmanship.
Wow, that is amazing. Somebody giving up a chairmanship. Let's go to South Burlington. Ben, good morning.
On the health care issue, I believe strongly that we should have a universal health care system paid for by tax dollars. Everybody gets insured. nobody goes without insurance. Everybody gets insurance. You keep the private insurance companies and stuff out of the system, and I myself believe that the business community, cries, oh, we can't afford it, when really they can. And the important point that needs to be made is that, a lot of businesses, or most businesses, are paying, for insurance anyways, privately a lot, and, those that don't, should be, but we're already paying for it. We're paying the insurance companies and whatever, right, but we're already paying for health insurance.
Let me interrupt, Ben. Thanks for your call. Did I want to pull something out of what he just said there. Yeah. Did Shumlin cave to big business on this? If I guess we call anything in Vermont big business.
Well,
it's important business, not big business.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
He did seem to tilt more toward the business community than anyone else at his press conference announcing that he was abandoning single payer. And I think what Ben was saying there was conspicuously absent from Shumlin's argument on single payer. The moral dimension, the idea that health care should be provided to everyone. Shumlin never said that. And he kind of ceded the moral high ground on the whole issue.
Really? He didn't say that?
Well, in recent months, at least during the election cycle and when he was announcing that he was killing single payer, he talked about cost and he talked about growing the economy and he talked about single payer as something that could grow the economy. He rarely, if ever, talked about fairness. Which was conspicuous to me.
And I want to talk a little bit about this $100 million gap. I was really interested in the piece you had a couple of weeks back that talked about how there's such a small discretionary amount of money that can be cut. It's like, our houses, the bank wants to be paid, the electric company is not going to take 10% less if you get a 10% cut in your income. So can you talk about that and how little room there is really to maneuver in?
Well, according to Steve Klein, the head of the Joint Fiscal Office, we would need to cut 25% of state government, essentially. We really only have $900 million to work with. It's discretionary. Once you back out federal funds and you back out debt service and retirement obligations and all that stuff, the budget amounts to $900 million. Oh, hang on. So that would be 10%, not 25%. I think I screwed something up. I think he must have said 400 million. So it's 25%.
Yeah, that's the number I remember. It was like it would be a quarter of sort of, I guess, what you would call discretionary money.
And the vast majority of that is in human services.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that at this point, they're going to be really taking some drastic measures. They're looking at cutting Medicaid in a serious way. They're also looking at cutting state workers' contracts. I think they're going to go back into the contracts for the next round of negotiations and really take a hard look at step increases. And they may eliminate a program or two.
John, I got to be real quick. Good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, hey, thanks a lot. Just an observation regarding the process outlined in the Constitution for the legislature to decide the governor's race. If I'm not mistaken, President Kennedy did not receive the majority vote of those who voted. and yet was installed by the Electoral College.
No,
so just an observation. Yeah, I'd like to hear some.
That's not correct.
Okay, I might be wrong on that, but there's the Electoral College. Sorry about that, Mark.
George W. Bush did not get that.
Oh, George Bush, okay. Yeah, there's a big difference.
We always confuse those two.
The Electoral College does have the ability to decide our next president of the United States, despite the majority vote.
Right. Right.
Let me get contrary. Similar.
Okay. Yeah. Anything you want to say to that, John?
Well, unlike the federal elections, we're bound by the Vermont Constitution in this regard, and a system that many think needs to change.
Of course, Kennedy did win the popular vote, but that Chicago vote count was pretty awesome that he had.
He won the dead guy vote.
Yeah. Thank you both for coming in. Please remember to take your coffee with you, too, when you leave. Our friends at the Vermont Coffee Company would like you to have that. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And see you all tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
That's going to wrap things up for hour number one. We'll be back in just a couple of moments. We'll check the news. We're also going to check in with our White House crew. And we expect to hear also this morning from Republican candidate Scott Milne. Keep your dial right here. FM 96.1 WDEV Warren and flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is coming your way next.